Earlier this year, United Nations Radio invited five men to tour Asia to observe that continent's economic and social problems and progress. They were representatives of the national broadcasting organizations of India, Indonesia, Japan, Malaya, and Pakistan. With them were two UN representatives, one from the Bangkok headquarters of the Economic Commission for Asia and the Far East, and one from UN Radio in New York. In this program, the first of three, based on more than 26 hours of recordings made during the tour, United Nations Radio invites you to join the international group as it reports on the sights and sounds of a continent in motion. We call this program From Asia with Modesty.
We start in Pakistan. The jet airliner which carries us there lands at Karachi Airport at 5 a.m. We buy a paper. The lead story on the front page that morning is headlined with these words:
Self-sustaining economy in 15 years. Hope of planning body chief.
Later that day, in one of Karachi's poorest parts, where former refugees are moving into new houses, we see a pottery business which some of the women are developing as a new source of income. Among the pots and plates and decorative pieces displayed on the sidewalk is a model of a rocket standing 3 feet high on its tail fins. The space age in ceramics. On a street where camels outnumber cars, and a boy with grave brown eyes and a withered leg hops after a bouncing ball. It's not a thing of beauty, that rocket. But along with the morning headline, it is among our first direct contacts with the meaning of two phrases that have been used many times in recent years: the revolution of rising expectations and the rebirth of Asia. These two phrases have many meanings, particularly the second. And to understand at least one of them, it's necessary to telescope 1,000 years, to put the distant past and the present side by side. In the jungles of western Cambodia, the voices of insects are shrill, and the muscles of nature have the strength to strangle the noblest works of man when he relaxes. As he once did in western Cambodia, at a place with magic in its name today for every student of human achievement, Angkor. At Angkor one day, we sit under a banyan tree and talk with a French archaeologist, Mr. Bernard Grolier. We talk of the great civilization that flourished there between the 9th and the 12th centuries, of the Khmer kings, and of the 200 temples they built. But these, Mr. Grolier feels, are not their most important works, lovely as they are.
The great creation of the Khmer as king from the 10th century onwards was probably the most extraordinary organization of the space, as we say today, for the benefit of their people. They began to dig canals, 100 of them, many more than 200 or 300 kilometers length. They began to dig and to build with dikes huge tanks, which could store each of them 60 million cubic meter of water. This water was used to irrigate rice fields in such a way that very likely Cambodians were able to harvest three crops a year and to sustain one of the highest human density known of the past.
But that was 1,000 years ago. Today, in the region of Angkor, they harvest one crop a year. But as we look around, we see that the old tanks and canals are being restored. New ones are being built. This work is one of the meanings of the word rebirth in Asia. And the rising expectations? This phrase, too, has many meanings, many human and material manifestations. As we drive south from Hyderabad in southern India, we drive through land that is hard and unresponsive. Outcrops of black rock punctuate the dusty flatness. Through 100 miles, we pass no more than 3 or 4 poor villagers. It's only too obvious that it can't be easy here to keep yourself alive. But after 100 miles, we reach the river Krishna and Nagajansagar. Here, more than 20,000 Indians, men, women and children, are building what will be the largest masonry dam in the world. It will rise almost 600 feet from the river bed. It will be 12,000 feet long. It will irrigate 3,200,000 acres of land. It will produce power. And after a day's work, cracking rocks, carrying them up bamboo ramps, setting them in concrete, many of the 20,000 still have the energy and the enthusiasm to gather at a community center, to sing, to dance, to laugh. We talk to the labor officer at Nagajansagar, Mr. Nagaswaro. One of our questions, and his answer to it, is this.
Since there is then a direct participation of by the people of this region, of this area, in the construction of this very major project, do they have a feeling that it's just another job, or do they have a feeling that they are somehow related very closely to the dam as if it belongs to them? Is that spirit prevalent?
Yes, they do have. They do feel that they are participating in a national project, and they have their own share in the execution of this great project, which is going to benefit them and others.
Rising expectations. And in Laos, too. Of all the countries of Asia, Laos is probably the least developed. Most of its villages live in isolation. There are few roads. Sometimes even tracks are scarce. In one of these villages, we meet Dr. Arthur Franz, a stocky man from Belgium, wearing a white shirt open all the way, white shorts and canvas boots, all stained with red dust and sweat. UNESCO sent Dr. Franz to Laos as a fundamental education worker. And he says to us, as the insects sing in the background,
I feel that I am an optimist because I feel that with the village people we can work very well. They are eager to learn and to know much about other countries. They ask questions about the population, about the products, about the organization of the country. Really, they are interested in every problem in which we are interested, and also in our families, asking, where is your wife? How many children and grandchildren have you? Do you grow rice in your country? And so on.
The rising awareness, prelude to expectations. Of course, between the expectation and the achievement stand many hurdles, some very real and specific, others broad, basic, almost philosophic. In fact, while we're in New Delhi, we hear perhaps the basic problem described by the Prime Minister of India, Mr. Jawaharlal Nehru. We meet him in his office in one of the government buildings standing at the head of the broad, tree-lined avenue which links the great arch of the India Gate and the high-domed presidential house and the Mughal Gardens. He makes the point that in the West, the Industrial Revolution preceded, by 100 years or more, the political revolution which gave everybody a voice in government, that is, full adult franchise. So that by the time this broad-based democracy became a fact, the economic and industrial resources of Western countries were sufficient to meet the demands of the masses. In the East, however, Mr. Nehru sees the reverse situation.
Now, in all these countries in Asia, newly independent, the political revolution, in that sense, has come before the Industrial Revolution. The political revolution has created and encouraged large demands from the people, and justifiable demands, one doesn't deny that. They want better living standards, why shouldn't they have it? The demands are justified, but the resources to fulfill those demands suddenly are not just there, because, as I said, the industrial apparatus of wealth production has not functioned. But there's a time lag between the demands and the resources to fulfill the demands. And that is a basic problem of all underdeveloped countries in Asia, maybe outside Asia too.
Though these demands can be classified under a few general headings, things like health and housing, education and employment, they can seem almost literally overwhelming when you multiply a single demand by the numbers making it. and realize that these numbers are not units on an assembly line, but people. The Prime Minister of Malaya, Tunku Abdul Rahman, speaking in his office in Kuala Lumpur.
Our difficulty has been perhaps the size of our young populations and the birth rate, which is very, very high. It's 3.5, if I'm not mistaken. And in a few years' time, we'll find that we'll have a very, very big population, and the country will then have a real problem on our hand.
In Indonesia, the deputy director of the regional housing center in Bandung, Mr. Lim Kai Shah, says to us,
in 1960, the total population of Indonesia has been estimated at about 90 million, of which about 80% live in rural areas and 20% in the towns. We have made a rough estimate also of the annual increase in population, which comes to about 2.2%, which goes up to 2 million of new people to be housed every year.
This, of course, is not the whole population picture. There is the argument that we already have the technical capacity and the resources to feed, clothe, house and employ everyone already living and expected to live in the future. And there is the fact that not every Asian country faces a population pressure problem. Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, we learn, are relatively underpopulated. And vast areas of India and Pakistan could support many more people if developed. In Bombay, at the Demographic Research Center, we discuss these questions with the director, Dr. Chandrasekaran.
In order to feed, clothe, educate all these numbers of people that are being coming into the world, it is quite obvious that you must tap resources. But even if technology can help in the development of these resources, it is fairly clear that the increasing numbers themselves will pose big problems of unemployment, of the utilization of a large number of people, and so on, with the result that problems of economic development become more and more complicated the faster the rate of growth of population. So in a nutshell, I think I agree with the theory that you formulated, that the rate of growth of population in this region is really hindering economic development.
We realize that before our tour is over, we'll need to come back to this population question, to the public and private views on it in various countries. For the moment, we store this population factor in mind as possibly the most influential of all in the determination of the future. It's an ever-present backdrop as we look at some of these specific demands. The demand for health, for example. The pattern of health, or the lack of it, doesn't vary much throughout Asia. Particular diseases like malaria, leprosy, yaws, trachoma, tuberculosis may be more prevalent in one area than in another. But localized problems aside, there are three dark and basic strands in the pattern which are visible everywhere. The first of them is ignorance, mass ignorance in health matters.
How old are you?
30 years.
How long have you been ill? Have you had any treatment already?
This is in Madras, at a tuberculosis chemotherapy center. The doctor's name is Angel. He's from WHO. Though he speaks Tamil, he is, for our benefit, conducting this consultation with a new patient in English. And his Indian assistant, a lady health visitor, is acting as interpreter.
Thatched house.
Thatched house. Yes. And what sort of walls?
Sever eppadi irukudhu?
Mud, sir.
Mud.
Mud walls. What happens to them in the monsoon?
Periya malakalathile enna pannuvinga nu kelugirudhu.
Nanaiyo. Oodu oodu.
It will leak, she says.
Has it ever completely fallen down?
எப்போவாது அந்த வீடு செவரெல்லாம் உடுந்திருக்குதான்னு கேக்குறாங்க.
இல்ல இல்ல.
No, she says.
Simply leaks. I see. Now, does she understand that she has tuberculosis?
உனக்கு இந்த வியாதி இருக்குதுன்னு உனக்கு தெரியுமா?
தெரியாது எனக்கு. மாசமா இருக்குதா இது? இரும்பிறது.
இரும்பல் வியாதியும் தெரியுமா?
தெரியாது எனக்கு.
She doesn't know.
She doesn't know what tuberculosis is.
No.
All right, well, ask her to listen carefully and I will tell her.
Millions don't know. That's dark strand number one. Number two is the lack of trained doctors and nurses, a lack ranging from the serious to the almost total. As, for example, in Laos, where Dr. Tom Dooley is one of the few at work, and where we are told...
We found that, first of all, we have to have stuff. And having stuff means creating them, making them, forming them.
This is a WHO man, Dr. P.D. Martin, working at a mother and child health center in Vientiane, Laos.
In the whole country, there are about 48 doctors, including all foreign doctors. Among the Lao doctors, there are only two fully qualified by international standards. The rest are officiers de santé. There is only one state-registered nurse, she is with us here in the room, trained for 4 years in France. And there are five state-registered midwives in this country, of whom one is here too. The rest are auxiliary midwives and auxiliary nurses.
Dark strand number three is poor sanitation and all that stems from it. Poor sanitation complicated by hard economic facts. We're at the Asian Regional Office of WHO in New Delhi. Speaking is the director, Dr. Chandra Mani.
While governments are very willing and eager and do realize that sanitation is a very major problem, they ought to do something about it, somehow or other, due to economic pressure and the extreme urgency of improving the production in order to raise the standard of living of their people, they are putting their major investments in those enterprises which give them immediate, visible, dramatic increase in wealth. While they have much sympathy with public health, they are not prepared to give it a high enough priority to make a tangible difference to the health of the people for basic needs such as sanitation.
Nevertheless, we will find later that the Asian demand for health has some very positive and encouraging aspects, too. Meanwhile, what of another demand? The demand for food, for better agriculture. We hear this sound in a Cambodian village. It's made by a very simple, almost primitive device for husking grains of rice. Two women stand, one-legged, on a narrow one-plank platform about 18 inches above the ground. They support themselves by grasping bamboo handrails. With their other legs, they pedal a second plank, resting on a crossbar, a fulcrum, in the middle. Like a seesaw, except that at the other end, there are no children playing. Just a rough-hewn hammerhead, which rises and falls into a sort of hollow stone cup set in the ground, into which the grains of rice are poured from time to time. It's a slow, laborious, inefficient process. It's a symbol of subsistence agriculture at its simplest. But we discover that it would be wrong to call this typical of the Asian agricultural scene. We hear from the Minister for Agriculture in Malaya, Mr. Abdulaziz bin Ishak.
Measures have been taken to increase the paddy yield by double cropping. This year, 10,000 acres are so planted. The target for double cropping is 100,000 acres within the next 5 years.
And in the Terai region in northern India, with the Himalayas as a backdrop, there is the Agricultural University of Uttar Pradesh, with a state experimental farm attached. We tour it with the Vice Chancellor, Mr. K.A. Stevenson, noting cattle and sugarcane and hybrid corn and...
We started breeding fish in this tank about 8 years ago, and this is the first tank in which mirror carp has ever been bred in captivity. They felt that mirror carp could not be bred in captivity, but it was proved, first of all, in this tank that we have been able to breed it.
Now, ye wo bada wala nikalo.
There are big movements to meet the demand for food, and there are big difficulties, too, such as the smallness of the individual Asian farm and the whole question of land reform. An example from Indonesia by the director of the Financial and Economic Bureau in Jakarta, Dr. Sobari.
Up to now, we have here still the unjust, unbalanced division of lands. Small group of people has very big lands, and the biggest parts of the people have nearly enough land to support themselves.
It's not easy to summarize the food and agriculture situation in the Asian region as a whole in a few words. But when we talk to Mr. W.H. Cummings, the regional representative of FAO in Bangkok, he says,
there has been increase in production. I would say it's not in quality of the production. There's been mainly an increase of the food grains, but looking at it from a dietary standpoint, we haven't got production of supplementary foods or protective foods. We have had increase in the basic food grain productions.
And the future, the possibilities for further increases?
The capacity for large increases in production on the land that's already in cultivation are considerable. For most countries, all the easy gains are yet to be made.
And if they were, you don't think even the growing numbers to be fed will be a problem?
I don't see the population growth catching up with that capacity if farmers are given these prerequisites to greater production and given the possibilities to produce, to realize the productive capacity of the soils.
On these points, as with earlier ones, we leave till later the gathering of evidence of what is being done to raise the quantity and quality of food in Asia. For there's still another wide area of Asian life for us to explore, an area in which today there is an immense demand, the demand for skill, for knowledge, for know-how. These are Burmese children, 4 or 5 year olds, in a nursery school in Rangoon. As they grow through the primary and secondary years of education, they're going to find that more is required of them than was required of their fathers. For Burma, like the rest of Asia, is changing, and the changes are basically technical. Among several illustrations of this growing demand for technical skill throughout the whole of Asia, we find one in Burma. On the banks of the swift, wide and muddy Rangoon River, there is the Dala Dockyard. Among the dockyard buildings, there's a school, the Regional Marine Diesel Training Center. When we visit it, 43 students are at work, 36 Burmese and 7 from other Asian countries. One of them is an Indian, Mr. Jitan Day from Calcutta.
What do you do in Calcutta?
I work in Calcutta Port Commissioners, Chief Mechanical Engineers Department.
In the Chief Mechanical Engineers Department.
Yes.
Have you experience of working with diesel engines there?
Yes.
Now, why have you come here for this training?
The purpose of my coming here is exactly we may learn something more about the marine diesel, as we have many diesel engines in our marine department.
Have you come across any particular problem in this training course?
Except theory. I don't find any other problems.
So what do you mean except theory?
Calculations. Theories of IC engines, internal combustion engines.
Mm. What is the trouble you have with them?
About calculations, which I cannot follow very much. When I left school and my studies, I didn't get touch for long, long years.
Uh-huh.
So I cannot get in touch with them. And that is the main problem.
Training men to maintain and operate diesel engines, of course, may not be the most important thing in the midst of a broad technical revolution. It's only part, one part, of a very big whole. But it does illustrate to us the nature of the problem very clearly, particularly in Burma, where inland water transport plays such a vital role in the country's development, and where diesel-driven boats are now commonplace. Commander Ong Thain, a superintending engineer of the Burma Inland Water Transport Board, tells us,
in the pre-war days, our fleet consisted mainly of steam vessels. And nowadays, we have started dieselization, and at present, we have about 50 steam vessels and about 250 diesel vessels. And as this dieselization comes rather suddenly, we find we are not best equipped to solve this problem of maintenance of diesel engines and for efficient operation of these vessels. So we find that training of mechanics and operators for these diesel engines is a very pressing problem.
Hence the training center at the Dalla Dockyard to serve not only Burma, but other countries of the Asian region. And the presence there of an expert from the International Labour Organization, Mr. J.T. Foster. When he talks to us, he raises a problem which obviously worries him.
The overall effectiveness of this scheme cannot be easily measured because one man may go back and revolutionize his own particular field of activity. But one of the more complicated problems is this. The regional countries can seldom spare the key men to come for this sort of training. And added to the fact that most of the regional countries require and desire national centers makes it very unlikely that the regional aspect of the program will increase very much. There seems to be no solution to this problem because the boys that come here benefit very considerably when they go back, but the numbers we can cope with under any circumstance would have a very limited effect upon the economy of their own countries.
So the need for more or larger training centres at both the regional and national levels is great, whether their courses be for diesel engineers or any other occupation. But as with other areas of our inquiry, we leave till later the gathering of evidence on what has been achieved in response to this demand for skills. For the moment, what have we forgotten in putting together this all-too-hurried sketch? We have forgotten many things. We have forgotten the new spirit of enterprise that is replacing the inertia, the sense of indolence that, at least in the eyes of the non-Asian, was once characteristic of the region. We have forgotten the new role of women in Asia, in government, in the professions, in education. Above all, we have forgotten the quality of the men and women we met in our travels, the quality that suggested the title of this program, From Asia with Modesty. The size of the problems facing modern Asia, the job of satisfying the demands we found, can seem literally overwhelming. Faced with this immense panorama, many people might clench a fist and thump the table in arrogance or anger, or let the fierce light of fanaticism into their eyes. But we found that this was not so. The prime ministers and ministers, economists, engineers and educators, businessmen and bankers, working women, farmers, and people with no claim to fame at all, there was in each of them, in every country we visited, a quietness, a rare sense of balance, and a quality that can only be described as modesty. Side by side with this modesty, we found yet other things. Determination, for one, and also courage. These we shall recount later.
From Asia with Modesty was the first of three programs reporting A Continent in Motion. Based on recordings made during a three-month UN-sponsored tour of Asia, it was written and narrated by Ken Pittendry of United Nations Radio. The second program, From Asia with Determination, will review the economic response to some of the problems presented during this half hour. This is United Nations Radio.